In the coming week, President Biden hosts a virtual democracy summit. The COVID-19 Omicron variant begins its spread worldwide, and Germany brings its new chancellor to power. It's December 2nd, 2021, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, next week, President Biden hosts a democracy summit. It's virtual, and it's going to include leaders of government, civil society, and the private sector. The State Department released a statement saying the summit will, quote, provide a platform for leaders to announce both individual and collective commitments, reforms, and initiatives to defend democracy and human rights at home and abroad, end quote. So, Jim, what should we expect from this summit?
As you mentioned, Bob, it's a virtual two-day summit that begins next Thursday morning, D.C. time. It fulfills a campaign pledge that Joe Biden made to hold a democracy summit during his first year in office. The summit has three primary themes: defending against authoritarianism, fighting corruption, and promoting respect for human rights. Leaders of the participating countries are encouraged to announce specific actions and commitments to meaningful internal reforms and international initiatives that will advance the summit's goals. That's taken from the same State Department statement that you referenced. The hope is that in a year, President Biden will be able to invite world leaders to gather for a second in-person summit to highlight the progress that has been made on the commitments to reinforcing, strengthening, and expanding democratic governance. Now, I have to say, Bob, that I am sympathetic to the idea of rallying democracies to tackle common policy challenges. But 15 years or so ago, Ewald Dalder, who's now the president of the Chicago Council of Foreign Affairs, and I wrote a series of pieces calling for the formation of a concert of democracies. But as we look at the approach that Biden is taking to the issue of democracy here, we can see the weakness in how many countries got invited and who got invited. 110 countries overall have been asked to participate, but only 70% of those invited actually qualify as free societies. If you look at the rankings provided by Freedom House, which does a very good job in this sector. So you're seeing countries like Pakistan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Serbia being invited to the summit, countries that don't normally come to the top of mind when you're asked to list democracies. And also you have invitees like Brazil, India, the Philippines, and Poland that top the list of democratic backsliders. So I think the administration is facing some criticism, justifiable, that the invitation to the democracy summit can look like a pass for these countries that have been curbing liberties and shrinking the democratic space at home. And that, of course, highlights the big elephant in the room, which is the democratic erosion that's occurring here in the United States. We obviously had the January 6th insurrection. We've had the peddling of the big lie that the 2020 presidential election was stolen from Donald Trump, and the push in many red states to restrict voting and to give legislatures the authority to overturn election results they don't like. So the whole notion of physician heal thyself comes to mind. And I think it's understandable why many of President Biden's fellow Democrats actually prefer to see him doing more at home to reinforce democratic small D safeguards than worrying about a big summit meeting. One criticism of the summit I wouldn't give much credence to is that it's introducing a new fault line in world politics. That's the argument that the Chinese and Russian ambassadors to the United States have pushed. They wrote an article in an outlet known as the National Journal arguing, and let me quote them here, countries should focus on running their own affairs well, not condescendingly criticizing others, end quote. That's a bit rich given how both countries happily criticize others and are eager to forge new dividing lines whenever it serves their interests.
It's a tough call because, you know, by any measurement, democracies have been backsliding, including robust ones, including the U.S. By many benchmarks. And it's kind of almost a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. Do something big and bold to lay out some markers, but then if you fail to meet those markers, you risk criticism as well as cynicism, and maybe the effort is undermined further. It's hard to say, Jim. I think certainly efforts within existing institutions or clubs in which the U.S. and its democratic partners belong, NATO and the G7, for example, could certainly help. I recall in my days covering the United Nations in the early 2000s, there was a budding movement there, the Community of Democracies, and it was countries like, it was the newly democratized countries of Eastern Europe. It was countries like Chile, even India was getting involved. There was even talk of a democracy fund to promote democracies. You had the UN Security Council supporting nation building efforts that were setting up democratic governments and endorsed by the Security Council, which included China and Russia in those days, and it still does. That all has gone by the wayside. But the question is, like, how do you stop stop this erosion. So I think at the end of the day, it's good to draw attention to it. Maybe some good ideas will emerge that will kind of percolate, and we can go from there. And I would note our colleague Jennifer Hillman's written a piece about, at the very least, you know, forging strong trade ties between the transatlantic partners is a way of shoring up that relationship.
Well, it certainly is, Bob. And there is a long history of democracies cooperating on substantive issues. And I think that should be promoted. The challenge here at the Biden summit is it's focused fundamentally on strengthening democracy. And it's not clear that international cooperation is going to be a big driver of that. In the countries we look at, whether we're talking about the United States or Mexico or Brazil or Poland, and the list goes on, the notion of whether democracy is strengthened or weakened is driven by domestic internal factors. It's not driven by what's being said at global summits and the like. So it's not clear how this is going to really sort of feed back into the idea of strengthening democracy at home. And again, one risk to inviting countries that are backsliding or witnessing democratic erosion or the shrinking of the space for political participation is it in some sense gives those countries a pass. It gives them cover to say, we're not backsliding because we're part of this broader movement. So there is a real risk there. Now, I have to acknowledge that the challenge for any administration is always going to be, how do you deal with countries that matter to achieving U.S. strategic interests that are witnessing or undergoing a democratic erosion? It's much easier to criticize countries in which you have nothing at stake. It's obviously a lot harder to do so when those countries are countries that you need cooperation from. A classic case in point for the Biden administration has been its treatment of India, where we have seen a significant erosion of democratic freedoms, and the administration has been very reluctant to speak publicly about it for obvious reasons.
That gets to one of the aspects that was brought up in that State Department statement that I mentioned at the outset, which is, you know, the twinning of defending democracy and human rights. Now, usually these are obviously integrated aspects, but the human rights part is becoming tougher, seemingly tougher to defend. You know, it's worth looking at the EU struggles at the moment to try to get both rule of law and human rights aspects reconciled with some of its members that are becoming, let's say, recalcitrant. Poland and Hungary, for example, have pushed against that and have been rebuked and have been warned and threatened for doing things like turning against or tightening controls over judiciary or steps against a free and open media. There have been countries that have been brought up before the human rights councils and so forth, and yet they don't want to kick them out of the club, so to speak. So it's like they're walking a fine line, and it's, again, human rights in particular seems to be an area that there's a real balancing act going on.
Certainly, Bob. And again, no one should be under the impression that these are easy issues to resolve, because in many cases, they involve the trade-offs between competing important objectives that governments have. And always in the issue of human rights is you have the reality that it can be very hard to influence how foreign governments treat their citizens, particularly when those countries are big and powerful. And the issue of Chinese treatment of the Uyghurs stands probably at the top of that list. But it's not the only example of how it can be tough to basically be able to translate a goal, a desire, into practical positive outcomes.
We'll see if the summit produces what they call deliverables, Jim, or whether there's a bit more rhetoric and substance.
I suspect, Bob, that if we get any deliverables, they will be on the soft side rather than concrete, tangible deliverables. But let's switch gears and talk about a subject we have been preoccupied with for the past 20-something months, and that's COVID-19. A new variant has emerged. It's known as the Omicron variant. It was first discovered in South Africa, but it's not clear that it necessarily originated in South Africa. Most of the Omicron cases that we know of have appeared in Botswana and South Africa, but we have seen cases in Europe, in South America, and even here in the United States. What do we know about this new variant, Bob, and what it means for the future of the global pandemic?
Jim, it's a fluid story. Things could change even after we tape this, and certainly we're going to find out more in the days and weeks ahead. At latest count, the variant had appeared in about 24 countries. It continues to generate concern, even as big questions remain about it. It's generating concern, and it immediately was flagged by health officials and then the World Health Organization because of the number of mutations. Omicron has about 50 mutations, 30 of which are said to be on the virus's spike protein. This is a structure that's used to connect to human cells. And some of the individual mutations have been linked to a decrease decreased protection against general infection. So a lot of concern about the impact of these mutations on vaccines that have been out there. Vaccines were seen as a big panacea, even as there was pushback against mandates. Still, vaccine distribution was seen as something that was continuing to grow and continuing to be the sort of way out, the off ramp from the pandemic. So South Africa's population did not have a high level of vaccination, something like 24%. A lot of Africa has a very low percentage of vaccination, despite many, many statements from health experts saying this needs to be something that's worldwide and that vaccine levels ultimately have to reach something like 80% to ward off effectively against any sort of potent mutations. I'll add one more thing that's come up in the sort of the health guidance on this, on the mutations. Again, why Omicron is of such concern. Immune systems are trained by vaccines to detect and target spike protein. So if there are changes in that, then it's harder for our bodies to recognize and provide an immune response. Again, this has many mutations, and there's a great deal of concern that while it might not be causing severe episodes of the COVID virus, it could still be highly spreadable. And that's the concern that the Delta variant, which is something the countries are still grappling with, including the US. So Delta has 10 mutations, new mutations, by the way, and has already caused a great deal of infection and death. So it's, again, COVID-19 is causing a lot of infections and a lot of hospitalizations, even as we speak, Jim. Vaccines have been shown to be very effective in preventing the worst of the illness and really preventing deaths. But it has generated a lot of pushback. Countries are trying to get ahead of Omicron. Jim, today, the Biden administration is due to announce at the National Institutes of Health new steps in making sure that people can get vaccinations and then that tests are going to be more widely available and that the country can respond in a more effective way if there is indeed a new spike in COVID coming through the Omicron variant.
As you know, Bob, this is a fluid story. There's a lot about Omicron we don't know. We don't know how effective current vaccines will be against it. We also don't know how Omicron variant might present differently in people who contract it, whether it will be a more dangerous, more lethal virus or not. Some of the early speculation is that it isn't. It is simply more transmissible. Now, that actually could turn out to be a positive story because it could end up driving out other variants, particularly Delta. And so you would have possibly a story where the virus becomes less pernicious. But again, we don't know. A lot more has to be done. I think there's some optimism in the vaccine world that even if current vaccines like the Pfizer and Moderna in particular aren't as effective against Omicron, they can be tweaked given the underlying mRNA technology to be able to address it. So there's potentially good news there. I will say that at least initially, the reaction in global economic markets, stock markets has been sharply negative. People are worried about, in essence, going back to where we were in the spring of 2020. That itself could have real-world effects, even if it turns out that Omicron isn't as dangerous as we might think early on. But what I want to ask you about, Bob, is how countries have reacted to the news of Omicron. Almost immediately, countries began slapping on travel bans for people coming from South Africa, Botswana, but also other countries in Southern Africa where there have been no recorded cases of the Omicron variant. Now, again, big caveat there, it might be that there are no recorded cases because those countries don't have the infrastructure to test to see if the variant exists. But I will note two things. One, it's clear that the Omicron variant is already overseas. I recently saw a report saying that Dutch officials went back and looked and discovered there was an Omicron variant or Omicron cases in the Netherlands in the middle of November before the news came out about South Africa and before the ban on travel. Second thing about these travel bans is that they are not aimed at all people coming from Southern African countries, but simply citizens of those countries coming there. So if you're an American citizen who's been in Johannesburg or Pretoria, you can still come back to the United States, presuming you've had a negative COVID test. Those kind of travel bans tend not to work because the virus doesn't care about your nationality. And again, it also may have a perverse effect or a perverse consequence. In essence, the South African medical establishment, which is actually very good, certainly within Africa, probably best in class, uncovered and shared information with the rest of the world. And now South Africa is in effect being punished for doing what you want countries to do in this situation, which is to share information. And again, the reverse impact could be the signal countries say is if we discover something that might be unsettling, we'll cover it up rather than to put a spotlight on it. That wouldn't be good.
No, Jim, I think you've pointed to something that's one of the many subplots here that needs to be addressed. There's a great deal of resentment and outright anger throughout Southern Africa at the response, at the international response, for the reasons you laid out. travel bans, you know, singling them out. These are the countries that put up the red flag that this was happening, and they see the response as a ban, whereas it's not even clear whether it originated there or whether they are extreme vectors. And by the way, you know, countries are still learning how to cope with this, but it was seen as kind of a knee-jerk response when not much was known yet about Omicron's spread. So I think, and at the same time, these are countries that were promised vaccine distributions in much higher numbers than they've gotten. As I've said, the numbers are extremely low so far. There was something like 944 million doses pledged by COVAX that would go to Africa. So far, something like 90 million have been delivered through COVAX and something known as the African Vaccine Acquisition Trust. Numbers of vaccination, in great part due to availability and sort of lagging distribution efforts, are really, really low in Africa.
Well, that's something that's actually worth emphasizing, Bob,
yeah.
Because it's not simply having vaccines. You have to have the ability to be able to get those vaccines into the cities, towns, and villages with the personnel who have the capacity to administer them. And again, you're looking at countries, particularly in Africa, but not just in Africa, that lack that capacity. So sort of getting from having a vaccine to getting it in people's arms can be much more difficult. I think in several of the countries that have fallen victim to the rather quick travel ban, they actually have been asking people to hold off sending them more vaccines because they can't use the ones they already have.
Absolutely, Jim. As a separate notion, sort of, you know, what could be a level playing field in terms of the way the world deals with this pandemic or future ones in terms of what is the playbook that should be observed? What is a testing protocol? What are vaccine requirements? This is still being sorted out, and countries, the United States very much included, are dealing with their own domestic pushback against mandates and against, you know, lockdown orders and such. So it's a difficult issue, but it's also created a lot of chaos and bitter feelings internationally where you have different requirements set up for different travelers. There's talk, revived talk of some sort of a global pandemic treaty. Maybe that could address some of this. It's not clear. In addition to this all, you have countries like China, where there have been multiple reports this week of Chinese officials exhibiting a bit of schadenfreude about their ability to keep COVID out of their country through really severe restrictions that they're going to stick with, and that they have the ability to, given the way China is governed, and that, who knows, maybe some other countries will take note of that and you know, sort of further set restrictions in place. Others are saying, you know, the world has to function, and, you know, we have to set up some sort of risk threshold and some sort of way to be able to continue to go about business, to keep schools and businesses open while taking prudent measures to fight against any further spread. It is an extremely difficult period. There's a great deal of exhaustion, frankly, among public officials, among publics in this country and others. And so it's creating a new trying moment, and we'll see whether Omicron is an inflection point or just maybe a ripple or maybe an opportunity, as you suggested, Jim, to move beyond and to create an end phase of this particular pandemic.
I think the big point here, Bob, is there's a lot we just don't know. And
yeah.
One thing we didn't mention was therapeutics. There have been some recent developments. I think Merck, Pfizer have come up with medicines that are designed to mitigate the consequences if you become infected. So sort of the opposite end from a vaccine. But we don't know how those therapeutics would do against something like Omicron. So again, I would urge everybody sort of listening, there are going to be a lot of conflicting perspectives on Omicron, its significance, how it's likely to play out. And unfortunately, we're just going to have to wait till we have some time and we can have the science to actually better understand what we're facing. And hopefully, we won't take too many imprudent steps before we actually know what it is that we're dealing with.
Yeah. And as you said, Jim, the science and then some sort of a policy consensus across, or at least across a critical mass of this country and others that can allow, you know, communities to move forward and for people to have sort of a shared sense of what's needed to be done. Jim, I want to turn our discussion to Germany, which in the midst of a political transition is dealing with its own coronavirus steps. Germany is where the Social Democratic Party leader, Olaf Scholz, is slated to become the next chancellor. This is a coalition he's going to lead involving the Greens and the Free Democrats, also known as the FDP. Scholz campaigned on the promise to follow closely in the footsteps of his predecessor, Angela Merkel. But Jim, can you give us a little bit more of a sense of who Olaf Scholz is and what steps we might see from him?
Certainly, Bob. But let's begin first with the mechanics of the transfer. The big news just before Thanksgiving here in the United States was that the Social Democrats, SPD, struck a deal with the Greens and the pro-business FDP, as you noted, to form a coalition government. This is the so-called traffic light coalition, named after the colors associated with each of the three parties. The deal both allocated government ministries among the three parties, and it set forth a policy platform for the new government. More on both in a minute. But the first thing is that the Bundestag, the German parliament, will vote sometime next week to make Scholz chancellor. At that point, the Angela Merkel era will be officially over after 16 years, and Scholz's chancellorship will begin. Scholz himself was vice chancellor and finance minister in the outgoing Merkel government, which you remember was a coalition government between Merkel's Christian Democratic Party and the Social Democrats, with Merkel's party in the lead. Now, Scholz himself, when he first joined the Social Democrats, was probably more on the left side of the spectrum. Over the course of his career, he has moved to the more conservative end of the spectrum in the Social Democratic Party, which should probably put him sort of in the moderate camp in the overall scheme of things in German politics. It's important to note that the coalition agreement contains several other major appointments to note. One is that Annalena Baerbock, who is the co-leader of the Greens, will become Germany's next foreign minister. She will be Germany's first female foreign minister, I should note. The other co-leader of the Greens, Robert Habeck, is expected to become vice chancellor, and he will oversee the country's energy transition. Now, Christian Lindner, who's the head of the Free Democrats, will become the finance minister. And right here, when you sort of talk about the top-level positions, you can see the potential tensions within the traffic light coalition. Social Democrats and the Greens want to spend more. The more conservative FDP wants to spend less. The Greens want more energy regulation. The FDP, which really represents the business community, liberals in the traditional sense, not the American sense, want less regulation. Now, again, the purpose of the platform is to try to limit those tensions by getting agreement right from the start as to what the government is going to do. I will note that when it comes to foreign policy, the platform lays out a range of standard German talking points. Critics might call them pieties, about the importance of a strong Franco-German partnership and a restatement of Germany's commitment to NATO. Where the platform is different and gets really interesting, Bob, is when it comes to China. The platform backs Taiwan's participation in international organizations, and it quite clearly condemns China's human rights abuses. Now, Beijing clearly was reading the policy platform agreement because it wasted no time in firing back, essentially telling the new German government to butt out of its internal affairs. So the big question is going to be whether the Scholz government actually ends up matching words with deeds, particularly when it comes to taking a stiffer line in dealing with China. And I will note that China is a major trade partner for German industry. So again, going back to a theme we raised earlier in our conversation, the German government is going to face some competing policy priorities. On the one hand, preserving German jobs. On the other hand, wanting to make the case for promoting human rights in China and elsewhere.
No, that's fascinating to be watching the China front and Russia to some extent, because you had, with Merkel's leaving, you had someone who had the ability, by many accounts, to be able to call up Putin directly, and they could speak either in Russian or German about matters quite candidly, and had come to some sort of realpolitik way of doing business. And we have the Nord Stream deal involving Russian energy coming into Germany in particular, and bypassing Ukraine. There's a bit of a slow walking of that deal now, according to German regulations that are being followed and so forth. But the extent to which that deal continues to move through, the extent to which Germany plays a role on the Ukrainian tensions that are playing out. And you have, with this new coalition, you have, again, this green foreign minister. I think it's the second green foreign minister, Joschka Fischer was in the early part of the century. It's going to be very interesting to see the way they deal with Russia, both publicly and privately. The other thing that's interesting for me, Jim, is as you were talking about the variations across this political spectrum, just how foreign it all seems to the U.S., where it's almost winner-take-all Democrat or Republican, and you're not having any kind of sharing it. I was trying to think about how such a coalition could work. It's as if Joe Biden brought in a libertarian as a Treasury Secretary, and then brought in a Green Party member to head the State Department, and it's unfathomable, really. But but it does show a bit of flexibility that some countries that are dealing with political divisions, like the U.S., might find a way out of their difficulties.
I don't know if it's actually unfathomable, Bob. We have seen American presidents, particularly Democratic presidents, inviting people from another party to take over a cabinet position, most notably. We saw Bill Clinton, Barack Obama have Republicans as their Secretary of Defense. But obviously, the American political system is different in that cabinet secretaries don't necessarily carry the same kind of weight as you might in a parliamentary system and in other differences among them. But I want to get back to your earlier point about Russia and particularly Nord Stream 2. What's interesting when you look at the German coalition agreement, it makes no mention, at least no explicit mention, of Nord Stream 2. Now, that could become an issue within the government because the various parties are in different positions on the issue. Now, Scholz has largely avoided talking about the pipeline. That might be because he doesn't see any political profit in it. It might be because he is a member of the government that supported the pipeline. Again, Angela Merkel was a big champion of Nord Stream 2. Baerbock, who's now going to be the foreign minister, has been vocal in criticizing Nord Stream 2 and calling out what she sees as Russia's energy blackmail. The one passage in the German coalition agreement that might refer to Nord Stream 2 is an unambiguous statement that European energy law applies to all projects in Germany. Now, as you mentioned, Bob, German regulators have held up the commissioning of Nord Stream 2 in recent weeks because the owner of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline doesn't have legal status under German law. But even once that hurdle is cleared, the whole issue has to go, as we discussed before, to the EU. So there is a possibility that this is a government that might, in some sense, take an overall EU position to avoid having to make a decision on its own. Again, big question mark there. Don't know that will happen, but it's certainly a possibility.
I think it's a country to watch very closely. Germany, again, largest economy in Europe, huge sort of moral stature as well. So you laid it out, Jim. We'll have to see how the messaging goes forth from here.
And I should note this, an alternate interpretation of the coalition document, which is if the EU approves of it, Germany can say it wasn't our decision, it was the EU's decision to go ahead with Nord Stream 2. Again, this could also be an issue in U.S.-German relations because there are a number of people outside the Biden administration who deeply dislike Nord Stream 2. And I will note, as we discussed before, also a lot of criticism of Nord Stream 2 in Europe itself. But let's pivot, Bob, and discuss our audience figure of the week, which listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, our audience selected Barbados Becomes Republic. What can you tell us about the audience choice, Bob?
Well, Jim, first, I'm delighted to, for the very first time, talk about Barbados, this, by all accounts, wonderful Caribbean locale.
It is a lovely place, Bob. Yeah. It is fantastic.
And a great deal of symbolism, but also a lot of important sentiment, I think, playing out in this role. So with Barbados declaring itself a republic, there's now, I think, 15 countries, including the UK, that are part of what's known as the realm, that have the queen as the head of state. These countries are all independent and sovereign states. Barbados was before as well. But with the role of the queen now removed, it's seen as taking another step against British colonial rule. Barbados and British history goes back a good almost 400 years. It was a slave labor dependent sugar colony in its origins. And so, as were other Caribbean states that remain part of the realm, let's look at Jamaica, for example. The queen had a head of state role. The sovereign appeared on country's currencies. It was a very much an important sort of symbolism to have the queen as sort of the head of the realm. But now Barbados steps away and it gives other countries pause and other countries that were under British colonial rule another reason to potentially petition for things like reparations from the slave period and so forth. We'll have to see how this plays out. Some people think it could be slow in coming. Other people think it could accelerate this move out of the realm. I should also note that Barbados is still part of what's known as the Commonwealth, which is of 54 countries or so. And this is a loosely affiliated group of countries that remain affiliated with the UK and are talking more about establishing bigger trade ties, especially after Brexit.
Bob, I have just one thing to add to what you just said, and that is during the ceremony that marked the transition of Barbados to becoming a republic, the Barbadian Prime Minister Mia Mottley told the crowd that it was designating Ambassador Robin Rihanna Fenty as a national hero. And again, if you are a pop music fan, you're very familiar with Rihanna, who was honored, and so tip of a cap to her.
Yes, that was a very significant move and another way of sort of putting Barbados on the map. Everybody knows Rihanna. I'm not sure how many people knew she was from Barbados. And it's an important symbolic moment, as I mentioned. It's a moment of independence and national pride. And I think it's important to note that Prince Charles was there and made a number of gracious comments about Barbados and Barbados' relationship with the UK. So let's see how this plays out, Jim. The Queen's role is getting more and more attention as she approaches 70 years as a sovereign early next year. She's 95 years old, has been in a little bit of failing health recently, but as I believe has rebounded a bit. So there's a great deal more of focus on what the monarchy means for the UK, what it means in terms of things like soft power as well as the symbolism.
Hard to disagree, Bob.
And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Russia's President Putin visits India for a summit with Narendra Modi. Americans mark 80 years since the Pearl Harbor attack, and a presidential election takes place in The Gambia.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. The articles and statements mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on CFR.org. Please note that opinions expressed on The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, none of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Maya Kinn, Charlotte Peterson, Anna Shortridge, and Rafaela Seward for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long, and please stay healthy out there.